Russia's war on Ukraine continues, with President Zelensky making another plea for arms to help his country. The US and its EU allies have bolstered his military, enabling it to fight back. But critics say that more weapons just means that more people will die. Is further military aid for Ukraine the way forward? This is Inside Story. Hello there and welcome to the program. I'm Nastasia Tay. Now, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has brought war between two European countries on a scale not seen since World War II. Death and destruction has been extensive, but Russia has been met with stiff resistance, and Ukrainian forces have also retaken some territory. Western arms and training have played a key role, forcing Russia to reassess its tactics. Moscow is now switching to long-range weapons and drones. Some critics of Western strategy say that pouring more arms into a war simply means more death and delays the need to talk peace. We'll be discussing all of this with our guests very shortly, but first, this report from Charles Stratford in Ukraine on the latest wave there of Russian attacks.
Torchlight guides shoppers along the shelves. Russia's almost nightly bombardment of Ukraine's electricity and energy infrastructure means millions of Ukrainians spend much of their daily life in the dark. Victoria is shopping with her three-year-old son, Daniel. They fled fighting near their home in the Kherson region in April.
The authorities tell us they've stabilized the electricity situation, and then there's another attack. It's been like this for the last 2 months. He's got used to the darkness, and importantly, he's not afraid. We have no choice. We have to get through this.
Emergency services battled fires across Kiev and various locations throughout the country after another Russian bombardment early Monday morning. This home was completely destroyed in a village close to Kiev by one of 30 so-called kamikaze drones the Ukrainian military says it intercepted.
We got used to what is happening. It's scary. Thoughts of possibly becoming homeless is terrifying. Everyone is scared, but we are bearing it.
Maria and Denis have to carry their 2.5-year-old son David up the stairs to their apartment on the 13th floor because electricity is down again, so the elevator doesn't work. 10 days after the invasion, as Russian forces advanced towards their apartment block in Irpin, they fled to the Netherlands and then France. They have only recently returned. Maria comforts her son in bed as she tries to send him to sleep. Denise has put plastic sheeting over the windows for additional protection against the sub-zero winter temperatures.
It's pretty hard, but we try not to complain because we think of our soldiers living in the trenches in dismal conditions. But on one occasion, we didn't have electricity for 2 days. Yes, it's cold. Sometimes the child is coughing. It's winter. But we can get through this. We wait for spring and victory.
Nearby is one of thousands of heated tents with generators put up in recent weeks, where people can get warm and charge their devices as work continues around the clock to fully restore electricity and heating across the country.
Russia's drone and missile attacks targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure are happening with increasing frequency. And that means that many people in neighborhoods like this one face another night without heating and in the dark. Charles Stratford, Al Jazeera, Kyiv.
While Western military aid has been critical to Ukraine's resistance and military advances, let's take a closer look at some of the numbers. In total, more than 30 countries have provided military equipment to Ukraine. The US has contributed the most by far, with at least $8.5 billion in military aid. Next on the list is Germany, which has given far less, just over $2.34 billion. And the United Kingdom follows, supplying weapons worth $1.9 billion. But Ukraine's president has appealed for more funding, saying that the monthly cost of defense is about $5 billion.
I ask you to increase the supply of air defense systems to our country and help speed up the relevant decisions of partners. 100% air defense shield for Ukraine would be one of the most successful steps against Russian aggression. This step is needed right now.
Well, for more on this, I'm now joined by all of our guests. In Kyiv, we have Peter Zalnayev. He's the executive director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative. In Moscow, we have Pavel Felgenhauer. He's a defense and military analyst. And in Riga, Latvia, is Leonid Rogozin, an independent journalist and publisher of a book called European Tragedy, A History of Russia and the Current Conflict. A warm welcome to you all. Thank you so much for joining us here on Inside Story. We know that Kyiv has been coming under renewed attacks in recent days, so I'll start there. Peter, presumably you'd like to see more Western weapons then to help defend your city?
Well, indeed, and this is something that we've been obviously warning about since at least October the 10th, which is the day when the first such strikes occurred. You know, we are hearing very positive signals from Washington that the Patriot air defense system may finally be given to Ukraine. This should have been done weeks, if not months ago, and it will still take a while to train Ukrainians to use it because America cannot send its own technicians to operate them or soldiers. That would be considered as participation, direct participation in the war. But this is a very encouraging sign, and Europe, the West, has finally realized that Ukraine's defeat will be its own defeat. That another, you know, tens of let's say millions of refugees flooding over the borders to Europe will overwhelm these societies, will create a significant problem for these governments. So, they need to do everything they can to help Ukrainians defend themselves from this terror from the sky that's been rained on us for weeks and weeks. Right now, I'm sitting in Kyiv. I'm lucky to have power on, but 80% of the Kyiv region at large is sitting now without power and some of them without water.
Well, just picking up on that, Russia has obviously been accused of weaponizing winter. It's sub-zero temperatures there. We've been seeing attacks on energy infrastructure. I know some defense analysts have been suggesting that this might be a Russian strategy to try to wear down Ukraine's air defense capability because it takes so many arms in order to try to defend itself. Pavel, do you think that's the Russian plan here?
Well, the Russian military have a very substantial upper hand in that they have capabilities to hit any target in any part of Ukraine, long-range capabilities that Ukraine does not. But the problem with this long-range attack arm of the Russian military is that they can hit only stationary targets and big targets. They can't hit mobile targets like, say, convoys or trains bringing reinforcements and weapons to the front line and from the west, because Russian bombers don't venture to fly deep into Ukraine at all. That means these are long-range missiles that hit stationary targets. The most easy stationary target are the Ukrainian grid system, and also defense industry. And also military camps, but basically right now it's the electricity power stations, but not, of course, the nuclear ones, but those that are producing electric power, hoping that denying electric power to Ukraine will put enough pressure on the Ukrainian government to seek a peaceful solution, to seek a ceasefire. Russia right now very much needs a ceasefire. For several years at least, but a ceasefire on Russian terms. So this is how they're putting pressure. They can do it, and they are doing it.
Well, if they're trying to put pressure on it, it seems to be backfiring somewhat because these attacks have only really strengthened morale. We've seen that in quite a lot of the polling that's been coming out of Kyiv. I know Ukrainians are saying, the majority of them, that they're resolved to now fight until victory. So trying to end the war, especially at this point, seems to be not the aim here. Ukrainians feel like they're making gains. They want the war to continue. Leonid, let me throw this to you. That sounds like an argument for more weapons from the West, then.
Well, I suppose so. And it's not inconceivable that more weapons supplied by the West to Ukraine will result in success on the battlefields and Ukraine being able to recapture at least the territory that was captured by Russia after February 24th, after the start of the full-out invasion. However, it is equally not inconceivable that there will be no success and that the missile strikes against the Ukrainian power grid will result in something akin to a humanitarian catastrophe towards the end or towards the middle of the winter. So it's a very, very complicated equation that intelligence services and the military in Western countries need to solve and to make a very accurate forecast. Because the cost of an accurate forecast is human lives and many, many human lives, thousands and thousands.
Of course. It's also not just more weapons, I believe, that Kyiv is asking for, but also more sophisticated weaponry. Is there potentially a risk, do you think, Pavel, of an escalation into potentially NATO territory if more sophisticated weapons are sent?
While Ukraine is asking for sophisticated weapons, it's getting sophisticated weapons since the war began in the end of February. The Ukrainian military now have capabilities they didn't have in the beginning of the war, and capabilities, some of them, that Russia also does not have. And that has changed the overall balance in the beginning or the first half of this conflict up to the midsummer, maybe. Russia had the initiative and the upper hand, though there were many mistakes made and many disasters happened, but still. Now the equation has changed. Now Ukraine has the initiative to some extent, and that's what means that there's going to be more fighting, and the fighting will get more severe. Maybe actually next month we'll see a major winter battle developing there. At least that's what many military experts in Russia and in Ukraine are predicting. And this may be a decisive battle for the future of this part of the world. Or maybe not, of course, we don't know for sure. But both sides are gearing up for that conflict coming up and gathering reserves.
Pavel, it sounds like you're talking about an escalation there. So let me ask you, Peter, as someone sitting in Kyiv now, is there a concern that more weapons could result in a further escalation, potentially even raise the nuclear threat? I mean, obviously some threats were made back in October.
Well, the nuclear threat is something that we would prefer to sort of bracket simply because we just, you know, this is the doomsday scenario none wants to contemplate. It seems plausible that the Chinese counterparts have made it clear to Vladimir Putin in recent meetings that they will not countenance the use of nuclear weapons. And so that is being relied on as a potential deterrent. Obviously, there's no guarantee of that. But if we simply just do not consider that, if we're talking about conventional weaponry, like I'm not a military expert, but you know, when we talk about escalation, that to Ukrainian ears, at least, sounds a little ridiculous. We're in the midst of the biggest European land-based war since World War II. Russia is already doing all it can to terrorize us. Vladimir Putin has made very clear his goal, and that is the disappearance of Ukraine as a sovereign entity, as a state. You know, sometimes the Western audience or worldwide audience does not understand the implications, does not understand the message. I mean, all you have to do is just understand some Russian to tune into these federal TV channels and to hear every day these calls for Ukrainians to be exterminated, for Ukrainian children to be drowned in rivers. This is Third Reich rhetoric. This is what Hitler said about Jews. There's really no difference. This is a genocidal war. And, you know, yet I agree with Pavel, the future of the rest of the 21st century and our security architecture is being decided in Ukraine, I think, Peter, and I hope the West understands.
Sure, there's obviously, there's obviously a lot of rhetoric flying around, but I do want to ask you a very basic question, which I'm sure a lot of our viewers are trying to work out at the moment. I think fundamentally people see more weapons being sent and they presume that that will mean the fighting will continue for longer. And as a result, the fighting continues, more lives are lost, and there's more destruction of your country. And there's obviously been hundreds of billions of dollars worth of destruction already, and you're living through and suffering through all of that now. Is there the appetite for that to continue? Is there not a worry that this will just go on indefinitely?
Well, if weapons are not being sent to Ukraine, then that means capitulation of Ukraine. And that's not an option to us who are Ukrainians and who do not want to be a part of Russia. 98% of Ukrainians now want restoration to 1991 borders. When we talk about this kind of weaponry and long-range missiles, that would be giving Ukraine symmetrical ability to strike at military targets inside mm-hmm. Russia, including those missile launchers from the Caspian Sea, which Russia is using to terrorize civilians. And that's what we're talking about.
OK, I want to broaden this out a little bit, because this is a war that's obviously had huge impacts, not just on Ukraine, but also many other countries around the globe when it comes to food security, energy prices, economic crises in various different places. Could more weapons, do you think, Leonid, prolong the suffering for everyone? And might that give other countries the impetus to try to resolve this in a different way?
Well, again, I would say that that depends on the accuracy of the forecasts associated with the supplies of those weapons. Yeah. Because if this war drags on for a long time, then yes, there'll be an impact on the whole world, on the European economy, and on the economy globally. So I'm sure that Western governments are taking this into consideration. And then also, yes, there is nuclear risk, which should not be exaggerated. However, we are talking about a very non-transparent group, a very small group that is ruling Russia, that is controlling this huge arsenal of nuclear weapons, which is capable of destroying entire humanity, really. So it should be a concern for humanity. Yes, on the one hand, it is a just cause to arm and support Ukraine, but also all these considerations regarding the future of the world, really, or the future of humanity, should be also taken into account. We don't know whether Putin is a suicidal person and whether his entourage are suicidal as well.
Okay. I want to turn to some of the pressure that's been mounting on different Western countries involved here, particularly the US. I see that just in the last few weeks, Russia pulled out of the New START treaty talks, their agreement to reduce nuclear arms, and they're trying to ramp up pressure, clearly, on Washington in order to stop supporting Ukraine. Pavel, do you think that's working at all?
Well, Russia is using, of course, the nuclear deterrent fully. As a deterrent, that's for what nuclear weapons were made, to use them as a deterrent, meaning, to in plain words, that's nuclear blackmail. But the difference between using them as a deterrent and using them, actually using them, that's the so-called nuclear threshold, and it is very high. So right now, it doesn't seem that anyone would want to go over that threshold, because that goes both ways. If you use nuclear weapons, you're going to receive nuclear weapons from the other side, sure, because both sides have deterrence there. So that's a kind of this nuclear deterrence that Russia is using against the West is modifying the Western support for Ukraine. Ukraine is not getting long-range missiles to attack deep into Russia, and most likely won't, because that is seen as too provocative. Hmm. Ukraine is getting battlefield weapons, most likely defense weapons, against Russian long-range attacks, like anti-missile, anti-aircraft, additional capabilities, which will more or less keep the situation as it is, or something like that.
Sure.
Battles of the winter. Yes.
I just want to bring in Pisa here, because we're talking about the U.S. continuing to send weapons to Ukraine as Kyiv and Zelensky have requested. But I'm curious, Pisa, at what point do you see those weapons stop? Because President Biden, at some point in March, he had some unscripted remarks that hinted at regime change in the Kremlin. But we've really had no clear objective from the US in terms of what they want to achieve here. So if you're sending weapons to Ukraine and you're the US, at what point do you stop?
Well, you know, I think it has a momentum of its own, you know, contrary to fears, initial fears that the Trump Republican-controlled Congress cut aid to Ukraine drastically. It hasn't happened. The Trump wing of the party hasn't really had much of a showing. And meanwhile, you know, the military-industrial complex of the U.S. is ramping up its production capacity. Its budget has been increased by Congress. So the momentum is still to continue this support of Ukraine, not without issues, not without problems and qualifications, but until 2024, until the new presidential elections, I think the inertia will maintain simply because, speaking of the population, speaking of just public opinion, the support of Ukraine in the US remains overwhelming.
Well, there is also public support for peace talks in various different places. So I want to turn to that. Moscow has a narrative that Ukraine is the one that doesn't want to negotiate. But from what I understand, Russia is demanding that Ukraine recognize geopolitical realities. I say that with quotation marks before coming to the table. So by my understanding, in order to sit down, Moscow requires Kyiv to make concessions. Leonid, is that essentially giving things away before you even start negotiating?
Well, the way I see it, the strategic goal of the Kremlin is to essentially to punish Ukraine for refusing to implement Minsk agreements and to punish it in general for being intransigent. So in that sense, it doesn't really matter for the Kremlin, I think, what percentage of the territory it currently controls will be left to it after the settlement. What's important for them, I think, is that Ukraine loses more than it had before February 24. And that I'm sure, includes the control of the parts of Luhansk and Donetsk regions that Russia currently controls. And also for Russia, it will be very difficult to part with the land corridor to Crimea, which they have gained by besieging Mariupol and Berdyansk. But all the rest is, I think, negotiable for the Kremlin. And any solution that will involve keeping those parts of Luhansk and Donetsk regions and the land corridor to Crimea, all of this can be presented by the Kremlin as a victory at the end of the day.
Of course. Well, one of the most powerful arguments that I've heard for making the West to continue its support of Ukraine has been around precedent. So they're saying, well, a number of analysts are saying that Western powers need to stay the course, to continue providing weapons and not necessarily push for peace talks right now, because what you want to do is prevent future escalation on the next crisis. Otherwise, Moscow is really presented a blueprint for not only Russia, but for other potential powers to get what they want from the West. Pavel, what do you make of that argument?
Well, many in the West, especially in Europe, would want to see a ceasefire happening. And Moscow wants a ceasefire right now, because the Ukrainian right now have more men in their armed forces and in many cases have more weapons. And Russia right now is struggling to replace the weapons and munitions we're using up. The intensity of the fighting is high, and I don't think that Russia can continue for a long time. Most likely, Ukraine also wants a ceasefire, but again, it's about the terms.
Sure.
What Russia wants, a freeze of what it is, more or less a freeze of the status quo for the time being, a line of control established, a kind of Minsk III. Ukraine is not ready for that. And that means, and the West is not ready to put any kind of real pressure on Ukraine, though, of course, they're holding back, say, long-range missiles that could be used from the HIMARS system for 300 kilometers. The Americans are not giving that, and the others are also not giving it, because these missiles are in other NATO countries. So there is some pressure on the Ukrainians, but no one wants to be seen as the one who forces the Ukrainians into a capitulation. So right now, I believe both sides actually have enough weapons there on the battlefield for one more very vicious battle coming up in the winter. Then there's going to be spring, and that means a lot of mud, and there's going to be a pause. And then there's going to be summer. By summer, maybe we'll have a ceasefire, maybe not. It depends how the coming battles turn out on the battlefield. That's where the decision is going to be made.
Indeed, and we'll continue watching that all very closely here on Al Jazeera. But for now, thank you to all of our guests, Peter Zalmayev, Leonid Rogozin and Pavel Felgenhauer. Thanks so much for joining us, and thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, that's aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, do go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Anastasia Tay, and the whole team here in Doha, bye for now.